Okay, thank you, David. Bonjour tout le monde. Pardonnez-moi, mais je parle seulement un peu français. Donc, je vais faire ma présentation en anglais. So, that's the limit of my French for today. I do apologize. You may not be able to read the subtitle of that picture there, but it says, Reality, the Worst Game Ever. An important point I want you to take with you today is to think about the fact that the whole of life is a game. Everything that we do can be considered as a game. And during this conference, like many conferences, you've seen some really good examples of how the technologies that are relevant to this conference are being used for specific applications. And there are many, many solutions in the health sector for training of staff, for diagnosis, for preventative interventions, and also for treatment. And as I say, throughout the last day and a half, you've seen some really good examples of that. I don't really want to repeat that. I will show you some examples to make various points, but what I want to try and do is to give you a totally different perspective, which brings some of my experiences, and you get some of those when you get to my age. I was born in 1949, so I'm over 60 and considerably older than many of you. So I want to try and give you a picture, a perspective of how technology has changed the whole healthcare sector, and what it might look like in 5 or 10 years' time, the implications for those of you who are already involved in the healthcare sector or are planning to be involved in the healthcare sector. So my key message really, I summarise very succinctly, is saying you ain't seen nothing yet. If you think you've seen some fun, amazing changes over the last couple of years, really, you're really at the dawn of something really quite remarkable that's on the way. And the point that I want to make is the kind of technologies that you've seen today, and particularly the concept of gamification, I think is, in my opinion, likely to play an extremely important role in addressing some of the major challenges that we will all face, not only in healthcare, but in the whole of society. So can I ask you, how many of you have employed gamification in your life? Really, I think that's... Ce n'est pas vrai. It's not true. Okay, it's not true. Every one of you in this room, I will guarantee, has employed gamification in your life. Now, this is an example of gamification. Anybody guess what I'm trying to do here? Nicole need answer because I've already told her. You know when you have a child who won't eat their dinner? What do? You make it into a game. You have a, here's the tunnel and here's the train, choo, choo, choo. And you turn it into a game. You make it a bit of fun and you give them an incentive and a motivation. Ladies, I would say that the female sex is the most accomplished of the sexes when it comes to gamification. So I ask you this question, is this gamification? In the game of love. Huh? You know all of the techniques. Another example there made me not read that. The girl is saying, you are so cute. Now be a darling and go and get another drink. It's a game. Same with facial expressions, eye-to-eye contact. Men do it as well as women, but not so well as women, if you understand what I mean. Okay? There's even a website called Flirting Games, which teaches ladies how to employ some of these techniques in different social situations. Here's another example of gamification. Okay, Obama and Putin, they're playing a game. They're playing a very serious game over Syria. In your own country, you've had examples of games in the French election. Here's another example of a game that children sometimes play. When they try things out, they don't want to go to school, so they try a little game of pretending to be poorly. And older men are also not immune to prey the game. Here's Brian. He's a victim of what's called man flu, pretending to be iller than he really is, playing a game to gain sympathy from his partner to develop a situation where she will support him and he'll be able to achieve an objective. So the one thing that's in common with all of these games that we play in our lives is that behind the game there is an objective. And we try out various tactics. We create rewards and we create penalties in order to achieve an objective and to engage other people in playing those games. So in any kind of game, there are really three main parties in the game. The first of these is the spectators. And spectators, whether they're games that we can all identify with, football, golf, familiar games, but in the game of life also, it's the spectators who finance the games and are very much affected by them. They affect their emotions, they affect the way they feel about their lives and about themselves. But in actual fact, spectators have very little influence over the outcome of games. Then you have the players. And the players themselves strive, they train themselves, they develop their skills and abilities with the intention of influencing the outcome of the game. But the real power behind games, in my opinion, are what I would classify as games masters. And these are the people who are very skilled at understanding games mechanics and psychologies. They shape the rules and mechanics to shape the outcome of the games, and they're often the most powerful influences. And from the top left-hand corner, you've got the gods, who often play a very strong influence in game. You could call that chance or fate. Many games are decided by factors beyond our control, incidents that happen that we have no control over. You have Bernie Eccleston, who is the power behind Formula One racing. And from time to time, they change the rules of the games really to keep the sustainability, to make the races more exciting instead of being dominated by one racer. And you've got Jose Mourinho, who is the manager of Chelsea, who's well known for his mind games. He describes himself as the chosen one. But he has an ability to influence his players and to motivate them and also to affect the mindset of other teams that he plays against. So you've got these three players, and these three participants are all present in all the games that we are talking about. So going back in time, this is a picture of me in my pram. And I was born into a world where there were no computers. Very few people had phones, and there were no cars. You know, you might think what a boring life it was, but it was a very different society from today, a very different society. And this is how things were when I was growing up. When I grew up, it was teachers who had the knowledge, and they transferred knowledge, and education was all about knowledge transfer. We knew all of our neighbours because we tended to spend our lives in the same community. We didn't travel very far. In those days, organisations had their own role and function, and banks were only banks. Grocers were grocers. Times have changed today, as you'll see. We tended to think about building a career in the same company and having the same kind of skills that we developed in our lifetime to progress. We dated and married within our own community, and our individual choice and power was very limited by the tools that we had available in those days. But even then, games and simulations helped to shape our development and interests. Did anybody play doctors and nurses when you were young? Yeah, there's a few. Yes, I think if anything like me, it was a way of finding out about what girls looked like, what the female anatomy was like. That was my motivation for playing those games. Society in those days was very hierarchical, structured and regulated, and knowledge was power. People who had knowledge achieved a certain status in life, which was reflected by their position and often their salary. So In the medical profession, knowledge professionals were, with years of training, were the sole providers in health, education, law, all of the major disciplines where knowledge was important. The people who delivered the services were people who had been trained over a number of years, and that was their profession. But digital technologies over the years have changed everything. This is a picture of the IBM 5120, which was the very first computer I sold when I joined IBM. And as technology developed from search engines, simple quizzes and decision tree games to more advanced realistic simulations, this is a few years old now, but you may still be quite impressed by the quality of the visualization. This was developed to try and illustrate how the games industry could use its techniques to create very realistic simulations which were connected to medical data. It was developed by a commercial games company called Blitz Games, and they were trying to they took a 3D scan, which you could do of anybody's head, and to simulate human emotion simply by algorithms which altered various parameters. So they could have scanned any one of your heads and simulated these emotions in a very realistic way. As I say, this is probably about 5 or 6 years old now. But then they started to link medical data into the simulation to show how the human body reacted with in certain circumstances. So this is showing respiration with heavy effort and then exhaustion. So the whole body behaved in a certain way. And then they linked medical data to show, in this case, somebody dying from a head wound. So on one side you see the normal condition of the patient. On the right-hand side you will see this man dying from a head wound over a period of a minute. It's a little bit scary because it's so realistic. You can see the health parameters of the patient in the top right-hand corner, and over the minute you'll see, not well in this light, but his colour changes to a grey colour. He starts to sweat. You'll see the veins pulsing in his neck as the heart tries to pump blood to the brain to keep him alive. And all of this is using medical data linked to animation. It's not traditional computer animation that's used within the games industry. It's connected to medical data. This is important because when you're training staff, it gives you an ability to create very realistic simulations without putting any patients at risk. So no human beings were harmed during the making of that that video. So that's one example from some time ago. But today, of course, it's a very different world, and knowledge and skills are available 24/7 on some very sophisticated platforms. And this is an example of a digital native who's got the multitasking skills or task swapping skills that were not very familiar to my generation. So if we jump forward to today, then things have changed an enormous amount. So teachers are no longer the fountain of all knowledge, and teachers are more like coaches and mentors. They're not there to simply deliver information. They are there to work alongside the learner as a coach and a mentor to facilitate the learning process. I don't know. I know one of my neighbours. I live in a block of flats, and I only know one of my neighbours. Very different to when I was growing up, and I travel an awful lot, and although I probably travel more than most, it's still very common for people to travel outside of the community. And these days, banks are no longer just banks. Record companies become airlines, grocers become banks. We change jobs and companies very often. We date via the internet and very often don't marry. And the important thing is that our individual and choice and power is becoming unlimited with the tools that we've got at our disposal. So whereas in the past it was an asymmetrical society, today it's becoming a network society, which is what I call asymmetric. By that I mean that the individual wields a disproportionate amount of power. So whereas in the past the people with the finance and the money wielded all of the power, or people with the knowledge, individuals can have a very significant impact on society through the communication tools that we have available today. So we've all got personal agents like the one that I'm using for my presentation. And we have innovative interfaces. This is an example of me wearing the NeuroSky headset, which is a device which monitors your brain waves and uses that information to be able to control the computer, can control a computer game, and increasingly these are starting to be used for treat conditions like autism or ADHD. And science fiction, the things that we see on the movies, soon become reality. So what you can imagine when you see some of these Hollywood movies with the special effects, it's not far from reality. And it's the immersion of these experiences which helps with the learning process. This is, again, it's not a new film. It was done quite a few years ago, and it was by the same company who did the animation of The Dying Man, and it was designed to train paramedics to deal with an explosion in the city centre with multiple casualties. So the paramedic playing this game has to go through the triage protocols correctly and to tag the patient appropriately, whether they're dead, whether they require emergent treatment, immediate treatment, whether they're urgent, or whether their treatment can be delayed. And they, the government, the UK government funded this with a view to testing the effectiveness of games-based learning against traditional methods. So all the people, they had two control groups, 50 learners who, paramedics, who were not all games players, there were different ages, different experiences. They learned by playing the game and were assessed by that. And 50, the other 50 learned with the traditional method, which involves actors and mannequins or dummies. And at the end of the experiment, all of the control groups, both control groups played, took the same traditional exam to test what they'd learned and their competencies. And the ones who'd learned by playing the game got considerably better results, significantly better results. And what these people said when they were asked why they thought it was that when they were playing the game, they felt they were much more engaged and they felt it was much more realistic. So they actually felt that they were saving lives when they were playing the game, whereas with the traditional methods, with the mannequins and the actors, they really just felt that they were just going through a learning process and the objective was more to pass the exam at the end rather than to get emotionally involved in the process. So once all of the casualties have been triaged, then the results are analysed so you can see what you did with each patient, how long it took you, whether it was correct, and where you needed to improve. So that was one of the few properly researched examples of projects designed to evaluate games-based learning versus traditional techniques. So moving on to where we're going in the future, one of the problems that I visualise now and in the future is that the level of choice and power that we have through technology, it makes us the most connected society in history. And yet, we're also simultaneously and paradoxically the most disconnected society in history, in the sense that there's a disconnection between the choices we make and the consequences of those choices. So I can perform an action, send a communication out, and I bear no responsibility for the consequence of that action. Power and accountability and rights and responsibility. And it's this disconnection that I argue creates some of the many challenges that we face. And in the medical sphere, society faces many, many challenges, obesity being one, and the ageing society and conditions like Alzheimer's Azil, that's a picture of my mother, who died last year of Alzheimer's after going through the typical path of being living in independent living accommodation and then requiring care and then eventually passing away. So I've seen some of the care that she had, and I honestly believe that that kind of care will not be available when I get to her age. So we have to find another way. The obesity, that is a picture of me 3 months ago in a play that I was in my local theatre. And that was one of the motivators that caused me to try and gamify my health and do something about it. So when we look at what games can do, they can train, orientate and assess stuff. Casual games, a lot now being able to help us develop and maintain cognitive skills and mental ability, not designed with a medical aim in mind, but still having some beneficial effects in that direction. We've seen examples of games that are designed to encourage behavioural change. In Stockholm seems to be the centre of the universe for some of these games experiments. This is a short video of an initiative in Stockholm designed to encourage people to use the stairs rather than the escalator. So I don't know whether that is still in existence, but you could see the gamification of exercise there. I'm, like Giancarlo, involved with Imaginary as well and some of their European projects, which are getting more and more advanced in the way they use technology and started to use reflective, personalised, adaptive learning and the wisdom of the crowd. So we're trying to develop games which are not fixed in the way they operate. They adapt to the learner and they also adapt over time and take advantage of the so-called wisdom of the crowd. I won't play all of this because you've seen similar examples. This is a Spanish company called Virtualware using the Kinect as a way of doing rehabilitation through using the Microsoft Kinect. And the important thing, I think, about this little demonstration is not the fact that it's using a Kinect and it's giving the patient a game-like environment to practice exercises, but I think the key thing is the tools that it provides to the physician to help the physician manage and tailor the exercises to the individual. So, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And the game itself, I'm sure within time, will also be able to be used to do some diagnosis of various physical conditions, which again helps to make sure that the therapy and the exercises match the needs and the capabilities of the patient. In the interest of time, I'll skip that, but I think you can see the ideas behind that. So my perspective today is that I think because of a range of technologies which are not just to do with the games engines that are being developed, but more to do with a whole range of different technologies that are converging. And one of these is the one that I'm using, which is on my wrist now. It's called a Jawbone Up. And it's an example of an embedded sensor. I wear this 24/7. And it's these sensor technologies, a whole range of them, which I think are going to transform society. Because we will have to do something. We cannot carry on the way we were. This is a graph that shows the growth in the numbers of people with dementia, with the projections. And you can see that in low and middle income countries, you're going to see doubling of dementia rates within the next 20 years, and we will not have the resources to be able to support the aging population and lifestyle-related health issues. So what do we do about it? Well, we've already got examples of the way in which technology can transform spectators into players by removing some of the barriers and adding the motivators. Okay, this is a trivial example, but golf tends to be, it's a very popular game. A lot of money goes into golf. It's watched by millions of people. But in a way, it's a little bit of an elite game because it's only people who can afford to be members of a club and have the equipment and the time to be able to play it. So people watch it and they learn about the game and they provide their own opinions about various players, but they don't have access to tools which allow them to play golf. Then the Wii Sports comes along. And they can get the same kind of experience as a golf player. So technology removes the barriers, adds motivation, and in the process, it turns spectators into players. So it's this combination of technology, particularly in my case, sensor data tracking technologies linked to games and simulations, which will provide the feedback and control mechanisms that we find in games that will help to reconnect society and, I think, address some of the problems which we're likely to face. Already in the UK, there are pilot schemes where people with obesity problems, instead of being referred to the hospital to have gastric band surgery, they're being referred to the gym. They're referred to the gym under the management of the general practitioner as a cost-effective alternative to gastric surgery. And the results that they're getting, because of the tools they have to monitor the activity and the condition of the patient, are producing significantly better results at a fraction of the cost. Projects like Do-Re-Mi, which is being at the moment under approval from the European Commission, will explore games and sensor technologies that support independent living. So we're transferring the responsibility and the power to manage health away from the medical professionals to the patients themselves, to individuals, and to their carers. So the whole dynamics of the health industry are likely to change dramatically. So in my case, I transform myself from a spectator to my own obesity. I always describe myself as technically obese, not obese, because technically obese didn't sound quite as bad as being obese. In 3 months, I lost 15 kilos by gamifying my situation and using the tools to monitor my activity, my sleep, the calories that I consumed and calories I burned. So I got to the point where I was able to predict how much weight I could lose and what I could eat and what exercise I needed to be able to do that. So prior to getting this technology and having a series of events in my life that motivated me to do this, I was only a spectator. And although I could read about good diet and exercise, I really didn't have the tools or the power to manage it. So these tools, and particularly the sensing technology developments in society, will help us to provide citizens to manage their own lifestyles and their own health better, and create new business models and opportunities to build a more sustainable future. So those of you who are now involved in the medical profession or going into it, you are going to face competition that none of your predecessors have faced. You are going to face competition from people who've had no medical training whatsoever. But they are able to deliver solutions to individual citizens which are attractive and, in many cases, effective. So this is something you have to bear in mind. You could regard them as competition, or you could be an opportunity to collaborate with these people. Just a little plug for my book, which talks about some of the changes that have taken place in my lifetime. And thank you very much for listening. I'm happy to answer any questions.
In this very precise case that you exposed us about the your journey through these 15 kilos lost, how do you point out the fact that you have been not only gamificating your how you did that, how you behaved during this period of time of your life, and what is the impact of the fact that there is this, let's say, device-supported action? Because you were using something like a Jawbone or a Fitbit or something like that, or only mobile apps in which you were inserting on a voluntary base some data about what you were eating, the exercise you were doing, and so on? Or have you had you a monitoring activity thanks to the Jawbone that you showed us, Fitbit, or today all these smart scales and so on?
Well, the devices I've got are the Jawbone. Oh, for those who don't know what it is, but it's a very clever device which is able to monitor your physical activity and your sleep, and visualize this through an app on the iPad. And this app synchronizes with this device, so I just plug it into the iPad, and it produces a graphical analysis. I'll show you just very, very quickly. So this is the application. And so I started 3 months ago. So this shows today, rather an embarrassing example, I'm afraid. So you've got the sleep on one side, and thanks to Pascal's generosity last night, I didn't get to bed till after midnight. But you'll see that I had some deep sleep, and my total sleep was 5 hours 16 minutes, and of that, 3 hours 15 was deep sleep. And you'll see also that round about 5 o'clock I woke up thinking about what I was going to do for my presentation, and then I eventually decided and I dropped off again then. So my target, the recommended target for me, a person my age, is 8 hours a night. And out of those 8 hours, then on average, I should be getting about 41% of that as deep sleep. I have a target for my physical activity, which is based on the number of steps that I walk in a day. My target is 10,000. So today I've already done 11,500. Well, that came about because you'll see this peak of activity in the morning. I got up. I got up and I had breakfast about 7 o'clock, and then I walked into the old town of Nice, walked back again. There's a gap there when I had a shower, and then I walked here. And you'll see at lunchtime at 1:30, I just had a little walk around here, and this made up the total steps, and it shows me the number of calories that I burnt. Sadly, my eating target went out the window today because I tracked what I ate. I had chocolate pastry, coffee and croissant and then I had apple pie, chocolate sponge cake, ham, and glasses of wine, which really boosted my consumption today way beyond what I've done. But if I go back, I can show the trends, which you can express day by day, which shows day by day calories burned, calories consumed, or week by week. But the best example, I think, is month by month, because really this shows my journey and explains what happened with me. So when I got this device, I just happened to read about it on the website, and it coincided with me seeing some pictures of myself from the stage performance and thinking, my God, I've got fat. And one of my friends saying, I'm worried about you, you're fat. And it just coincided with that. So I got the device, and I'd already got an iPad, and the app is free to download, so I'd all try it. And the first thing I tried was really just continuing to eat as I'd always done, pretty much, just not quite as much, and then exercising more. And then I realized I wasn't losing as much weight as I wanted to. So the next stage during July and August was when I went on holiday to Provence. I had 3 weeks on holiday where I was my own bungalow. And it just happened, and this just shows you how the gods and other the games masters intervene in your life. It just happened that when I drive down to Provence, and I stay at two places on the way down there, and on the second place I stayed with a friend of mine, we went to a barbecue at a neighbour's house, and she had a bit too much to drink, and said, her daughter's actually said, would you drive mum home? And we don't trust her. So I drove her 4x4, and instead of going on the main road, which I wanted to do, she insisted on taking a shortcut through the fields and the woods to her house, and I had a minor collision with a bridge. It was very minor. I was doing about 1 mile an hour, and just this bridge rail was hidden by the undergrowth, and I just clipped it, and it did €2,500 worth of damage. So I was faced with a bill. And so when I got to my holiday, I had decided that I needed to restrict my budget. So I lived on €5 a day and cut down what I ate quite a lot. So in that 3 weeks, I had intensive exercise. There was one day when I did the equivalent of 30 miles walking. I had a routine every day. I walked into the town and back, which was got me about 30,000 steps, but then there was a disco in the night and I danced for 3 hours solid, and that got me another 15,000 steps. So that 3 weeks, when I got back to England there, I lost 10 kilos in that 3 weeks. And now I'm not too far off where my a kind of target that I've got in my mind to achieve, and now it's sort of just about regulating that balance between exercise and diet. And what's different in my life is that I have these tools which don't interfere with my life that give me the visualization and knowledge to be able to play this game. That's what I mean, that I'm no longer a spectator, I'm a player.
What's interesting in that very precise point is that I just put you, I compare your experience to the experience of people I know, and more precisely a friend of mine. She's conducting a Weight Watchers diet.
Yeah.
And she's not feeling confident with Fitbit, Jawbones, and so on. And she said, I got no money to put in a Jawbone or Fitbit or whatever. So what she decided to do was kind of also, you are the hero of the story. She decided to take a picture every morning of the breakfast she was about to eat. And according to Weight Watchers rules, where you give some points to the food you are about to eat, she was every morning showing all her Facebook friends, 8,000 people, what she was about to have for breakfast. So some people, some friends were just saying, okay, you are really a hero because you are in a so courageous way to lose weight, and you face all your 8,000 friends looking at you every morning and having probably some comments. And some of them were actually writing some very disappointing comments and some very disgusting comments even. But the thing is that that was more or less for free. I mean, it was device-less, regarding to what you did with your job on. And so it's the reason why I asked you this question about the fact that how does this device-centric, or not, but at least device-helped situation, how you qualify that according to the, let's say, to the generic concept or term of game or gamification. According to the fact that, for instance, I gave you this sample of this lady having more or less the same process that you had, but deciding to do that on a much more theatrical way.
Well, I also did that, what your neighbor did. I took pictures of my breakfast and put them on Facebook. And I also had pictures of myself and put that on Facebook. And I had comments like, "My God, Dave, is that you?" this is a true story, but I think it's very funny. I also had a wireless weigh scale, and with the wireless weigh scale, you synchronize it to your iPad. So when you stand on it, it gives you your name and it tells you your weight. But I didn't take it on holiday with me. I wanted to see whether the efforts I was making, I could predict what my weight would be. So I left it at home and waited till I got back to weigh myself again. So I weighed myself after 3 weeks and I'd lost almost 10 kilos and my weigh scale didn't recognize me. It put a question mark against the person. Is this really you? So, yeah, I use Facebook as well. So you'll see these are some pictures from my Facebook pictures from my holiday, and in there there are places that I visited, but also there are pictures of the meals that I had. So it was not, it was a social network. It was, you know, and the gamification, it wasn't that I was given targets by some external source. I set myself my own targets. But I could do that with some kind of understanding of what I needed to do to hit those targets. And I think this is the important thing about gamification. Games, to a large extent, are... Somebody described games as being an ability to control the uncontrollable. The best and most addictive games are games where you have an experience of being able to, even if it's only once in your life, to control the uncontrollable. So that one sweet golf shot that you drive down there, you never ever repeat in your life, but it lives in your memory. Or if you scored a fantastic goal. These are the kind of things that addict you to games. And it's the same with this. It's bringing into my life some control over something that previously had been uncontrollable. And so I think just generally, with a lot of medical conditions, it's not just the patients, but it'll be the carers who will be provided with visualization of data, social network tools, which will allow them to do some of the support that today is done by medical professionals.
Thank you, David, for your presentation. It was very interesting. I have a question about your vision of our society after your history. It's very interesting to see that today we have unlimited choices. Accounting, you said that we have unlimited choices, yeah. And maybe unlimited power. So for me it's a bit strange, because I think that if we have a lot of choice, the possibility to choose in our society today, at the same time our society become more and more complex. So, as we spend a lot of time to choose, it's become difficult to have powers to decide, to do something, to change things in our societies. It seems to be more and more longer to have impact in this kind of society. So, I would have your point of view about that.
Yeah, it's that's something of a paradox. I want to say you have unlimited power. What I mean is that individuals have the ability to cause consequences through their choices. They have the power to make consequences through their choices, but not necessarily the control over the consequences of their choices. You see what I mean? So you present a lot, you travel, you will be surprised how many people know of you or have had information from you. Thousands of people that you've never met or you never will meet. But even if it's only a tiny change, you will have had an influence on people's lives. And in some cases where people have ill intent, they can cause very... very disruptive changes to our society without bearing any consequences. So I'm not saying that you can deliberately influence society by your choices. What I'm saying is that there are consequences. You've got more power, you've got more choice, and whatever you choose will have consequences that you're not aware of and that you don't bear any responsibility for. It's perhaps because I have an engineering background, and I still remember in my thesis university, I developed a feedback control system, which is very important in games. Games give you feedback. If you don't get feedback, then you haven't got any control. And so it's the same with society. We are causing actions, but there is no feedback to us and very few mechanisms to actually control and manage that. And that's the dangerous part about it. And so with me, if you take health as an example, I'm fortunate enough, touch wood, to have been healthy throughout my life. But I can't say that I've been very diligent with what I've eaten or what I've drunk. I got fat because I ate too much. It really didn't matter to me, to be honest, that as long as I was healthy and as long as nobody laughed at me and as long as I still had my friends, I didn't care. But I expected that if something went wrong with my body, then I would get free health care and the taxpayer would pay the bill, or my insurance company would pay the bill with fixing it. So I really didn't have any responsibility for my lifestyle or the consequences of it. And what I'm saying now is that not everybody will take advantage of this, but I think there are opportunities to make those connections between your lifestyle and the consequences, so you take responsibility. And I think over a period of time, the games masters, for want of a better word, if you could say the politicians or the health policy makers, will use gamification to provide motivations, incentives, and also penalties to encourage people to do what I've done. Simply because not only for the benefit of the individual citizens, but also for the benefit of society as a whole. Because I don't honestly think that we have the resources to be able to continue to live the lives that we currently live, not just in healthcare, but in the environment and many other areas as well.
Okay. I think we should finish there. I just want to say that we have influence over each other's lives to a certain degree, and what I can say is that Dave has very positively influenced me. So I think he's doing that for everybody here. So thank you very much.
Thank you.